This is the Jeff Merrick Show on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Welcome back to the program. Glad to have you aboard once again. And normally we hear the dulcet tones of Greg Wyshynski from ESPN on Wednesday, but he is gracing us early this week. It is, after all, Tuesday, and we welcome him aboard. Hello, Wish.
Hello, everybody. How are you?
Doing well. Hey, before we get into the playoffs, something that very much piqued my interests, because this happened when we were doing the old MVSW podcast. Vancouver Game 7 Riot Doc is part of the 30 for 30 slate this summer. I'm just here for the Riot Chronicles, the aftermath of an event captured on hundreds of cell phone cameras. The rioters are outed, shamed, and see their lives altered forever. I can remember, because it was, like, for people that were in and around the Stanley Cup Final, Vancouver and Boston, was very much where were you when the Vancouver Riot started. And I can recall I was doing the iDesk with Scott Morrison at that point, and we were out on the atrium at CBC in Vancouver, and the first explosion went off right outside the post office, which was about half a block from where we were, and then CBC security just sort of grabbed us and took us all inside. And essentially, as everything sort of escalated and the cops came and the tear gas and the fights and the darkness and everything, they said, well, you can stay here as long as you want, or you can get out and try to walk to your hotel. And so ScoMo and I decided, yeah, we're going to walk, not realizing all the crystal meth fights we were going to see and the beer bottle smashing and the horses and the cops and all of it. And I was saying to Maddie off air, I remember walking into a restaurant because I saw Michael Landsberg, and I was talking to Michael, and someone from the restaurant said, well, you have two choices here, everybody, because we're not going to let, because this is when the riots are going on, worried about everyone's safety and certainly the safety of the building. We can't allow you to stay in the restaurant. You can do one of two things. You can either get out onto the streets where the rioters are and take your chances, or we're putting all of our staff in the freezer. And that was a decision that people at this restaurant were sort of forced with. And listen, you and I were doing the podcast at the exact same time when this was all happening. A, what are your memories from that one? I've got a ton after having walked through the riots themselves. What are your memories from that?
Covering it from afar, because at the time, Nick Katsunika and I were both at Yahoo.
Yep.
And we were splitting. He was in Vancouver and I was in Boston for that series. So he was on Game 7. And I remember, you know, he wrote a very strong first person story column about being in the middle of that stuff. But the thing I remember is sort of like the covering it from afar of monitoring all of the Vancouver media feeds and seeing reporters doing stand-ups that were slowly descending into chaos.
Yep.
And then the biggest thing I remember, obviously, besides the kissing couple, which was a story that I retold on a recent episode of the ESPN Daily podcast, but it was the aftermath of it. And I think it was the mayor of Vancouver claiming it was anarchists.
Wasn't hockey fans, because they all happened to be wearing
vintage, you know, Trevor Linden shirts, but
most anarchists I've found wear Christian Ehrhoff jerseys. I've found that in my extensive study of anarchists.
But again, the thing I most remember about it, and I think we mentioned this on the show at the time, is like there was no other way that series could have ended, right? Like the series will go down as my favorite of all time. Stanley Cup final series, maybe championship series.
Right.
Not because of quality of play, but because of the absolute soap opera that it was.
Yeah.
It was violent and it was nasty. And it seemingly every game there was a new controversy, whether it was the tire pumping taunts between the goalies or the Aaron Rome hit or Marchand using the Sedins as a speed bag. Like, every single game had this enormous soap operatic storyline. And so win or lose, Vancouver burning their city down was probably the logical conclusion to everything we had seen before that.
It was one of the more bizarre things I've ever been part of. I'll be honest with you. And again, like, I wasn't even inside for that final game. Scotty and I were outside the atrium at CBC. And you're right. Like, when you think of, like, the larger-than-life personalities that were involved in that series, you mentioned Brad Marchand, throw in Zdeno Chara and Milan Lucic and Ryan Kessler and the Sedins, like, Luongo, Tim Thomas. Like when you think back, like as far as like star power, or not just even just star power, but like unique personalities of the game. I have to go back and sort of, you know, go through all the rosters. But when you just look at it from a hockey character's point of view, it's kind of a dream final, no? And then there's always the added element of Canada versus U.S., et cetera, mm-hmm. That plays itself out. Like, it kind of was the dream final.
Well, not only that, I mean, it was Canada versus U.S., but it was also this absolute mania surrounding the Boston Bruins. Like, the first team to come back from the dead was the Penguins with Sid. And then after that, you had the resurgence of Chicago and the resurgence of Boston. And those three teams, maybe more than, I mean, you'd have to include the Ovechkin rivalry in this too, and the outdoor games.
Yep.
But like the reemergence of those three franchises as Stanley Cup contenders had as much to do with the NHL picking itself off the canvas after canceling a season for a work stoppage as anything else. Like, but the Bruins, people forget, like, because it's been like 15 years, the Bruins were a moribund franchise.
Yep.
This was a team that Jeremy Jacobs had sort of like overseen mismanagement into the ground. The Joe Thornton.
Oh, the Thornton deal.
For God's sake.
Yeah. The Thornton deal.
So
absolute low point.
So to have them return to a point of prominence and to have them challenging for their first Stanley Cup, you know, since the 70s was a very big part of why that series got the attention that it did. And then the most miraculous thing about that series was how this team from Boston that everybody in the Eastern Conference hated because of Marchand, because of Lucic, because of the way they played, because of their swagger, their attitude, the Boston of it all, because this is also a post-Red Sox victory Bruins team, right? So Boston's all swaggery. They became the faces in that series against Vancouver because Vancouver was that much more loathsome to the hockey community writ large than the Bruins were. Where people started rooting for the Bruins because they didn't want to see Ryan Kessler and Alex Burrows win a cup.
Or LaPerriere.
Yeah, exactly. So we could talk about that series for months because it's still in my mind is so fresh. And I think about it all the time when we see incidences of violence in the playoffs or trying to mold and shape a rivalry into something worth tuning in for.
Okay.
I think back to that series, I'm like, oh my God, you guys have no idea how it used to be.
That 14 years ago,
no less, or whatever it was.
I know. Crazy. And listen, trust me. I mean, every generation does the, oh, you have no idea what it was like 15 years ago. Just like, you know, anyone who went through like the Philadelphia Flyers and the Boston Bruins in that era of hockey will say like, oh, you had no idea what it was like to play in the mid 70s. Half the team should have been incarcerated. And they were right. Let me follow up with a question about the Bruins here, because listen, the Boston Bruins are getting handed, you know, their butts by the Florida Panthers, and whether it's, you know, sneaky rabbit punches or whether it's, you know, controversial goals, whether it's big hits, all of it. I find it a little bit hard to take hearing Boston complain about it, considering they've been serving the same stuff up now for about 15 years and now the tables are turned. Is there not an element to you, as there is to me, of the Florida Panthers are out-Bruining the Bruins? Like, this is what it was like to play you guys for the last 15 years, and this edition of the Boston Bruins doesn't like it. Thank you very much.
I think it's more that the Bruins no longer Bruin, if that makes sense.
We're stretching here. I'm with you. I know what you're trying to say, but I just realized.
You know what I'm saying?
Maybe I'm stretching here.
Hey, listen, because I listened to Boston. I drove from Boston to Bristol yesterday after game four to do our show, The Drop, in Bristol, Leonardo. And I had the joy of listening to Boston Sports Talk Radio on the way to Connecticut. And most of the discussion, besides what's wrong with McAvoy and all the usual stuff, is like Don Sweeney has built a team that is no longer tough. And Don Sweeney has built a team that can no longer take a punch. And there was a lot of that. Now, listen, I don't know if that's necessarily like the reason they're succeeding or failing in the playoffs. But I think there's a sentiment in Boston that they've gotten away from their identity, if that could be the word that we use for it. And, you know, there's something to be said for that in a series that is this physical and this brutal and does have guys like like Bennett and Tkachuk and others that can certainly, you know, get physical when necessary. But it's not the reason they're losing. The reason they're losing is that, and this is what's more interesting about America, is that like the reason they're losing is because this team is a shell of what it was depth-wise.
Yeah.
The team last year was, you know, the Marianas Trench compared to this team as far as depth. Mm. Like you're seeing kids having to come in and fill roles that should not be filled by 22-year-olds in a series against the Florida Panthers. And then you're looking at all the contributions the Panthers are getting up and down the lineup. Like you saw the cracks in the armor last round against Toronto,
yep.
Especially at the center position. Like they were good enough to get through the regular season, amass a bunch of points and do quite well based on the foundation that they had with McAvoy, Lindholm, Ullmark, Swayman, and Jim Montgomery's system. But then when you get in the playoffs and it becomes a 7-game sprint and it's all about matchups, it gets really laid bare, the thinness at center and overall the thinness on the roster. And it's the reason they're losing to the Panthers right now.
The other reason is the Florida Panthers are just better, like bluntly. And honestly, it is just a better hockey team. And it does seem to be very much a team. Like everyone, like to a player, whether it's Barkov, whether it's Rodriguez, whether it's Bennett, whether it's Tkachuk, whether it's Montour, do you not get the sense that with all these Florida players, they love everything about the playoffs? They love that every single shift is for keeps. Like, I got to tell you, this is one of the most impressive teams that we've seen in the past few years. I mean, last year was anything. I mean, maybe getting in was a quote-unquote fluke because a lot of things had to go right. And, you know, if Bobrovsky doesn't make a save on that Brad Marchand breakaway, we're not talking about what happened last season with the Florida Panthers. But this is a team that just loves everything about playoff hockey. Like, there are some teams, like, you can tell. You can tell, like, a team that really doesn't like it when it gets uncomfortable, when, you know, every hit is for keeps and there's, like, the gap is so narrow and everything is really uncomfortable out there. And then there are some teams that just relish it. And I can't help but watching the Florida Panthers and say, these guys love playing hockey like this. Like, Bill Zito, like, I've made the point a couple of different places that, you know, it should be no surprise to remember that the first acquisition he made was Patrick Hornquist. And symbolically, that was, we need to be more miserable to play against. We need to be harder to play against. We need to be hated. Other teams need to hate playing against us. And Bill Zito went out and constructed a team that other teams hate playing against. These guys, Greg, love the playoffs.
But here's the other thing that they do that may even be that's even more important than their physicality. Now people hate playing against them because you only get like 15 shots against them.
Yep.
and I wrote about Bobrovsky this morning on ESPN and sort of took a look at the playoff Bob legend and or myth. And I talked to a bunch of the Panthers and they all said the same thing, which is that they know his stats and his stats stink. I mean, outside of Stuart Skinner, he's the worst goalie statistically in the playoffs right now.
Mm-hmm.
But they value what he does with the limited work that he has. And they think that he is doing some really remarkable things given how few shots he faces. And if you look at back last year, I mean, the disparity is stark. And granted, some of those shot totals are inflated by overtime games, a particular one that went 4 overtimes.
Yeah.
But on average, like, I think he's facing like close to like 10 shots less a game than he was last year in the playoffs. And like, it is pretty remarkable that when you're a goalie that faces high volume and then you have to go to being Marty Brodeur circa 1995, to kind of manage yourself mentally in doing that is a skill. I was talking to Kevin Weeks about that. It's like, you know, it's a skill to be able to prepare yourself to be as good as possible on those few moments when you can affect play. It's just like, and Paul Maurice said, you know, it's a skill that only a veteran goalie like Bobrovsky is going to be able to have. So in a way, he's the perfect guy for the way that they play now, which is to frustrate the hell out of you,
yep,
by not allowing more than like 15 or 18 shots a game.
Pekka Rinne, when I'm hearing you talk, and all I'm thinking about is when the Nashville Predators transitioned from Barry Trotz to Peter Laviolette. Laviolette was very much on shot suppression and nothing's going to the net. Barry Trotz understood that, you know, Pekka Rinne needed to have like, you know, 15, 20 shots in the first period to get a feel for the puck. And Pekka Rinne struggled. Like, that's like a real thing. Goalies that are used to having a lot and feeling it, and then all of a sudden, like, there's stretches where nothing's going at the net and you can't feel the puck and you can't get into a groove. That's hard. Like, I know exactly what Paul Maurice is talking about because we've seen, like, you mentioned Marty Brodeur, look at Pekka, like, there's other goalies too that it is hard. I've always maintained this. It is harder to only face 20 shots a game than 50 because how many of those 50 shots are going to be grade A chances? That's just volume shooting, and all that does is A, it warms up your Corsi, but two, it warms up the goalie. And which is why, let me get on my soapbox here about this one. Whenever there's a goalie change, okay, like there's two schools of thought. So team pulls a goaltender, in comes a new goalie. One side of wisdom says, new goalie, he's cold, throw as many pucks on him as possible. I go the opposite. I say, this guy's cold, keep him cold. Don't shoot until the perfect time. Don't let him warm up. Don't let him touch the puck a bunch. Don't let him move around. Keep that goalie cold. Which side are you on? Warm him up, keep it cold.
Probably warm him up, I think.
Just throw a lot of pucks at him?
Why not? Dude, how many times have we seen a puck go past somebody? Brandon Carlo had a goal in the series where he just threw a puck on net and it went through the guy. No, I'm a pepper the goalie guy. You never know what's going to happen. You never know if he's going to be out of position slightly. You never know what's going to, you know, bounce off of something or take a weird wobble. I'm someone, and again, like, what's interesting about Bobrovsky is that he did face a team in the first round of Tampa that is very much pick your spots.
Yeah.
And very much like they don't shoot a lot. They're looking for that perfect moment. And I think you can afford to do that when you have an assemblage of talent like they do. But I think for most teams, it's like just pucks on net. Why not?
Well, I'd agree with you if you were right, but on that, we'll move on. let me ask you about this one. I thought that Jared Bednar, I think, struck the right tone yesterday after the game, after the loss against the Dallas Stars, when asked about Valeri Nichushkin. And this is now two seasons in a row, pretty much at identical times, when we've seen him go through a relapse. Listen, we all know that Valeri Nichushkin is going through something, and something awful here. And I understand there's going to be a lot of different emotions, and we saw that spelled out from whether it's Andrew Coghlan or Cale Makar to perhaps most strongly Jack Johnson, where he essentially said, he made his decision. That's all I'm going to say about it. He made his decision. I was talking to someone on the way in today, an ex-player who's gone through this before, and we were talking about relapses. And he said, you know, listen, one thing you have to remember is relapses are still part of the disease. That is still baked into the pie here. I don't want to fault anyone for, I don't want to like point fingers at someone to say like the way you feel is wrong. Cause I don't believe in doing that. We saw a wide range of feelings, whether it's players, whether it's coaches, certainly whether it's fans. How did you see the Valeri Nichushkin situation yesterday?
Well, I mean, I think like you said, it's a delicate balance between acknowledging the disease and acknowledging the inherent disappointment in a guy with 9 goals in the postseason having to leave the postseason because of you know, violation of the treatment policy for the NHL and the NHLPA. Jack Johnson's comments, like you said, I think were the starkest, because you do get the sense reading between the lines that this is something they've dealt with internally.
Yep.
And that this was something they thought was in their rearview mirror, maybe, and there was probably an inherent trust that they put in Nichushkin that they feel like has been violated. And again, it's tough to talk about this without acknowledging that addiction is a disease, and he's going through some things that are extraordinarily serious and needs help. But it's also undeniable that the Avalanche certainly felt enough trust in him to have him on the roster, have him play a prominent role, and to think that the rug wouldn't be pulled out from under them at any point, and it has been.
Now for Colorado, it's going to go one of two ways. One way is now they have the excuse. You know, they're down 3-1 to the Dallas Stars, and they have the excuse. So it could go that way. Dallas playing some great hockey. Or it could go the rally around this by the team. Makar, Rantanen, MacKinnon. It's going to go one of two ways here. I don't know, and I don't think you know. I don't think anybody knows which way this thing is going to head right now. All I know is the Dallas Stars are not going to make this easy. The Dallas Stars are playing some of the best hockey we've seen in the postseason, albeit Colorado were doing statue practice for 20 minutes yesterday to kick off the game. How are you seeing this series right now with the fact that Valeri Nichushkin is not part of it? I know Roope Hintz is a big injury, and you know, you hope for Dallas' sake that he's going to be all right. That's a tough one. How do you see this series right now?
I just don't think it matters how Colorado internalizes any of this stuff, because Dallas is better, and they're playing better, and they're overwhelming them, and they got their game in this series, and I don't think you can knock them off their game right now. I'm just playing well. They're coming at you in waves. I think I mentioned this last week or week before, but the Jim Nill template for this team is remarkable. And Nill's a guy that I think gets a sufficient amount of praise as a general manager, but probably not enough, especially for his work in Detroit, if I'm being honest. Mm-hmm. But I mean, you think about the top layer of guys searching for their first cups, they've got the hunger. Then you think about the number of guys that are in their prime, you know, your Robertsons and your Ottingers and players like that, and Hintz as well. Heiskanen. And now you've got this infusion of two of the most impactful young players that we have in the playoffs right now, Wyatt Johnson and Logan Sankoven. It's just, it's a remarkably well-constructed roster. Obviously the Tanev acquisition was also a huge key for all of this happening right now. I'm just really impressed. Like, if you were going to have kind of build a team mode in a game and, as a GM, like, this is the kind of team you'd build to win a cup.
Yep.
And that's why what's happening right now in the Colorado series has much less to do with the Avalanche and much more to do with Dallas really kind of actualizing in a way that they didn't necessarily at times in the first round.
I find it fascinating as well, though. What was it, Greg? Like, 3 years ago, everybody on this team was getting fired or traded. Remember that? There was that time where it was like, yeah, Nil's going to lose his job. Like, everyone's getting fired. All the scouts are getting punted. And then all of a sudden it clicked.
The team CEO calling out Jamie Benn and Tyler Seguin.
Right? Remember? You know, remember? Yeah.
The good old days.
Yeah, the good old days. There was chaos in Dallas. Now it's just like, they're just awesome.
Hey, let it be a lesson to you, Toronto. Keep doing this for the next 10 years. Don't change a thing.
Don't change a thing. You got them right where you want them. We started off the conversation. We're talking about the Vancouver Canucks, and we'll see them tonight against the Edmonton Oilers. I was mentioning earlier that this is going to be one of those games where you learn a lot about Edmonton. Not that I expect, you know, Corey Perry to chase, you know, Pedersen all over the ice. Not that I expect Vincent Desharnais to chase, you know, Quinn Hughes, even if he could catch him, all over the ice. But this is going to be one of those games where I think we learn a lot about the Edmonton Oilers. They've been outplayed. Vancouver is deeper. The goalie is winning the goalie battle. And then Connor McDavid, you know, got cross-checked both from behind and in the face after the game was over. Which the point that I've been trying to make about that one is not the fact that Soucy cross-checked him in the face. That's like, whatever, we've seen a million of those in hockey. But the fact that Vancouver feels that they're in a position where they can do whatever they want to Connor McDavid, whether it's during the game, whether it's after the game, that they're skating with that kind of confidence. To me, that is almost a bigger story than the suspension itself. How do you see this series right now?
Yeah, who knew you'd see that from a Rick Tocchet team? I do find it interesting, like, the reaction to the McDavid suspension, because we did start off this conversation talking about the Vancouver Riot, which gets us talking about the Vancouver-Boston series, which gets us talking about the idea that star players should be protected. Mm-hmm. Skill players should be protected from extracurricular activity. And I remember that being a very big thing in that series when, again, Brad Marchand was using the Sedins as a speed bag in front of the net. And I find it very intriguing, the moments of, I'm sure, what was a deep personal reflection on the part of Vancouver fans as they lambasted the NHL for suspending Soucy for this cross check and proclaimed the NHL is overprotecting its star players. It wouldn't have happened if it was McDavid.
Mm.
How interesting times have changed. I'm less interested about how Edmonton responds physically tonight than I am interested in Chris Knobloch making his first super important decision as head coach in the National Hockey League. I think that he's done a very good job in turning the season around. I don't think he should get a lack of credit for the things that he's done behind the bench, the lineup changes that he's made, the management of this roster, the defensive structure that he's helped instill. But he still went 46-18-5 at a time when Connor McDavid was finding his game again, let's say, in a way he did not when Jay Woodcroft was the coach for 13 games. Well, now we put on our big boy pants and we've made a goalie change. And the interesting thing about the goalie change is that Stuart Skinner does something pretty well, which is win after losses. In fact, in his last 10 losses, Merrick, he's 9-1 after those losses, okay, including, I believe, 8 in a row, including a couple in these playoffs. Now, he didn't play all that well after the loss of this series.
Yeah.
It was much more, I think, Edmonton playing well in front of him. And herein lies the interesting thing about Calvin Pickard being the goalie. I don't think this is as much about Stuart Skinner as it is a signal to the team that now there's no safety net. Now there's a novice back there. Now the backup's in. So if you guys don't play better in front of that guy, well, now things could get real ugly. I truly think this is more of a message to Edmonton systems-wise, execution-wise, than it is about the two goaltenders. And if it works, great. And if it doesn't, well, then it just keeps not working for Edmonton in the series.
Well, what is, though, the bigger problem here? Is it net minding for Edmonton, or is it Vancouver's got better depth? Like, they're just a deeper hockey team.
They're not, but that's, I think you're wrong on that. I think the difference is that Edmonton's depth is getting outplayed. Because they've got, it's not as if this is it's not like a two-guy show like it's been in previous seasons for Edmonton. They've got guys down the roster that can perform and that have performed this season. They're just invisible this series. And while Vancouver's supporting cast is completely playing well. I mean, that's, to me, you hit the nail on the head, though. Like, for all this hand-wringing about Stuart Skinner, you know, and his save percentage, the real issue is that the Oilers at this point are having to play their top guys 30 minutes a night in the second round in order to compensate for how bad the rest of the team is playing. That's the real issue. Like, you know, let's not overlook Vancouver here, because Vancouver could probably win this series.
Yeah.
But like, if you're looking down the road for this Edmonton team and taking the long view, you're playing McDavid and Draisaitl insane minutes, and you're not even in the conference final yet. So that's the real pickle for this team right now. It's like, they're getting no help. They're getting zero help at 5-on-5, and that's what's killing them.
So of all the teams here, whether it's the Boston Bruins, the Edmonton Oilers, the Colorado Avalanche, and the Carolina Hurricanes, if they lose, which market is the most chaotic? Which organization turns itself upside down here? Because I really do wonder if we're there with Carolina now. I mean, the Edmonton story is going to revolve around July 1st and Leon Draisaitl. That's going to be obvious. Boston, well, I would imagine Don Sweeney is going to want to do a lot of things in the offseason if/when they bow out against the Panthers. Who has the most chaotic offseason if they lose?
Do you think that Draisaitl would go to San Jose because their owner is German?
I think there's an opportunity.
Have you ever heard that?
Yes.
I heard that for the first time the other day, and I'm like, oh, all right.
Yes.
Okay.
That's kind of been whispered for a while now.
Burgeoning market.
Yep.
Great young players.
Mm-hmm.
They will obviously compensate him.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, it's interesting that we both have heard this in the ether, in the spoken whispers in the back of all the hockey, where all the hockey men are.
I think people have speculated on that now for at least a year, maybe longer, as you sort of try to look down the road at, you know, what could happen with Leon Draisaitl here in this next contract, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, congratulations, listeners, to the Jeff Merrick Show. Welcome to the Cigar Bar. We just in here, a little scuttlebutt, a little innuendo. To answer your question, it's obviously Edmonton. One, because, like, it's gonna get ugly in Boston. Like, but I think that people know what needs to happen in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's easy to just look at the situation here and be like, all right, we'll trade Ullmark, we'll convince him to go somewhere, we'll get something back, we'll increase the depth, and we'll figure out, we need to get a center.
We'll trade Ullmark, we'll bring in Elias Lindholm.
Yeah, sure. Why not? Like, yeah, I mean, the fixes there, I think, are a lot more apparent. Carolina is interesting, because I think ultimately, what's going to happen, win or lose, in the series is that Tom Dundon goes to Don Waddell and says, here's the number. If Rod wants it, great. If not, we'll just, you know, move on. And knowing Rod, he'll take the number because he wants to stay in Carolina. What was the other one? Colorado. They're fine. Colorado's just got a lot of noise going on right now. Like, I think they're fine. I think they know their window is still open. I mean, you know, Makar is so young and McKinnon's still in his prime. Rantman's young. Like, I think they're fine. The answer is probably Edmonton. But the question was interesting because you included Carolina in that group of teams.
Well, how many times? Like, how many?
But you said they might lose. And I got to tell you, I covered that game last night, and then the Rangers are saying all the right things. And I think they know inherently that if they go three games without scoring a power play goal, that could easily turn around in game six if they can score a power play goal. But I said this after game four that there was absolutely nothing in the Hurricanes game four win that would give me or give the Rangers any point of concern. It's not like Freddie Anderson stopped 41 of 42 shots.
Right.
We played a lot better in game five. And the Hurricanes played a lot better in game five. Jordan Staal told me last night that their 5-on-5 game is strong, but it's getting better. And that, you know, going back to the beginning of the series, was always going to be the Achilles heel of the Rangers against Carolina. And now the Rangers have allowed the series to get back to one of the hardest places to play in the league in a game six.
Yep.
Against the Carolina team that is gaining its confidence and playing its game again. I still think the Rangers win the series, but I felt a little sweaty. It was a little sweatier last night. I got more texts from my Ranger fans' friends last night than I expected, that were like, what is happening? Is it okay? Yes. Please tell me it's all right. So that series has really taken an interesting turn.
There's a lot fewer Ranger fans in my timeline. Over the last couple of days. They were loud early, especially when I said things like, I think Carolina probably played better than the Rangers in that game. Whoa, did I ever hear about it. Anyhow, listen, you enjoy your week. We'll talk in 7 days. Be well. And always love hearing you in these pressers and reminding coaches that you're from Brooklyn. that made my day. I'm like, there's my Greg.
A lot of people were very sad for me because later on he assumed that since I was from Brooklyn, I was a Rangers fan. And they're like, that must have hurt even more. I'm like, you have no idea.
You have no idea how much of a Devils fan this guy is. Oh, my God. Okay, you be well.
I didn't want to extend the presser any longer than it already had gone.
You should have just been, well, actually, Paul.
No.
Waiting for that one.
It's despite everybody believing that I made it about myself, I truly don't want to make it about myself when I'm in a situation like that. So I was willing to just let Paul have his fun and go with it. But, man, it's been a while, Merrick, since I saw a coach walk into a press conference and look for a fight. That man was looking to just call out some media people in that presser. Good on him. It was fun.
I love it. I will make it all about you. Don't worry. You don't have to. Everybody else will. You be well. Take care, Wish. Talk in 7 days, buddy. Greg Wyshynski from ESPN and The Drop.